to Afghanistan now, where a prominent cleric was among 10 people killed in a bomb attack inside a mosque in Kabul overnight. It's the latest in a series of terror attacks that have occurred around the first year anniversary of the Taliban's takeover of Afghanistan. Security observers are now questioning whether the Taliban is losing the war against the local branch of Islamic State, known as Islamic State Khorasan or ISK. Joining me now is Ahmad Shuja Jamal. He's a former Director General of International Relations at Kabul's National Security Council. Welcome to you, Shuja.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
There's been a number of significant attacks in Kabul recently. Last week, a prominent pro-Taliban cleric was targeted and killed in a suicide bombing. A year on from claiming victory and retaking the capital, just how tenuous is the Taliban's grip on power?
I think what these recent spate of attacks reveal are two things. Number one, that the Taliban's claim that with their coming to power violently, they've brought peace to Afghanistan, and the ISIS attacks show that that's not the case. And number two, that their claim of having vanquished ISIS in Afghanistan is also clearly and patently false, because ISIS has demonstrated an ability to attack not just against Taliban ideologues and clerics, but also against the populations in the country that are vulnerable, including the Hazara and Shia populations that ISIS has historically had such a zeal against and been violent towards.
For those that don't know, just explain the kind of difference in ideologies there is between the ISK and the Taliban, and also why the Taliban have not been able to stop these terror attacks.
Well, the ISIS is the branch of the global Islamist fundamentalist movement that is calling for the restoration of the caliphate. And if you remember al-Baghdadi, who was the so-called first caliph of ISIS, who revealed himself to be in Syria a few years ago, was their leader. And so the Taliban, on the other hand, are Islamist fundamentalists who want to serve under an emir and not a caliph, and they want to serve inside of Afghanistan and not globally. However, these distinctions often blur, because the cleric that the ISIS claimed to have killed last week in Kabul, who was a supporter of the Taliban, also shared ideological opposition against the Shia. Both that cleric and ISIS believe that the Shia Muslims are actually non-believers, they're kafirs. And so both of them agree that the Shias should be on the receiving end of extermination and violence. And so even though there are political differences as to their aspiration, ISIS wants a global Islamic caliphate, the Taliban want an Afghanistan-bound emirate, both of them want the rule of Islam in their respective geographies, but both of them also share ideological commonalities. The other thing is that several, in fact, hundreds, maybe even thousands of former Taliban fighters who were disgruntled by the Taliban have actually joined ISIS in Afghanistan and have now padded their ranks.
It does seem kind of ironic that the Taliban, who for so long fought the US as insurgents, are now confronting the same sort of asymmetric warfare whilst in government. You'd think they'd know how to confront this sort of menace, wouldn't you?
Absolutely. I think what this reveals is the Taliban's ineptitude to be a government. They have shown to be a resilient, very deadly terrorist insurgency, but they have shown very little, if any, aptitude for being a government. They have been a regime that has embarked on what they call a moral reform process in Afghanistan, mandating beards for women, mandating face coverings and hijab for women, mandating this and that for social reform. What you're seeing, not just in terms of ISIS, but also other resistance movements inside of Afghanistan, both armed and unarmed. In terms of armed resistance movements, you see the National Resistance Front, which is the largest group, but there are also smaller, other small-scale resistance popping up against the Taliban's violent opposition on Afghanistan. The Afghan parliamentarians, for example, who are now in exile, are considering ways of convening virtually in order to demonstrate that they still remain a viable democratic institution that Afghanistan, the people of Afghanistan, aspire for. So you're right in that the Taliban have displayed very little, if any, aptitude for governance, that their governance methodology is violent suppression of any dissent, and that methodology is actually eliciting a resistance from the people. Women on the streets demanding their rights and protesting, but also armed opposition across the country.
So is it almost at the stage where the Taliban are appealing to other sovereign nations about support to deal with this sort of insurgence? Is anyone offering them help? Are they asking for help?
Well, the Taliban are actually not asking for help in suppressing ISIS. The Taliban are trying to tell the world that, look, after 20 years of instability in Afghanistan, we have now brought peace to this country, which means that for the first time in 20 years, Afghanistan is at peace and ready to deal with the world. And so you, the world, should actually recognize the Taliban regime as a legitimate government in that country so we can start dealing with you. There are a number of problems with that, obviously. Number one is that they have not brought peace to Afghanistan. And number two, that they have actually, as you can see from the attacks by ISIS and others, and number two, that the people of Afghanistan do not recognize the Taliban as a legitimate government because they're violently imposed. And number three, that the Taliban are not the kind of responsible international actor that the world wants to deal with, which means that if you are hosting the number one leader of Al-Qaeda in your capital, and that you are bringing back people like Hikmatullah, the turncoat former Taliban infiltrator who killed Australian soldiers, and if you are putting in ministerial position FBI most wanted global terrorists, who is now a current interior minister, that you are not a trusted international actor, that the world is not willing to deal with you as a legitimate actor when you're engaging in these sorts of behavior.
Yeah, I want to return to the topic of Hikmatullah in just a moment. If you're listening to RN Drive, you're listening to Ahmad Shuja Jamal, a former Director General of International Relations at Kabul's National Security Council. Has the recent killing of the Al-Qaeda leader Ayman al-Zawahiri had anything to do with things in Afghanistan? I mean, it sort of showed up the vulnerabilities, if you like, of the Taliban leadership, that they couldn't protect him even in downtown Kabul.
Well, what it shows, though, is the duplicity of the Taliban leadership, because in February of 2020, the Taliban signed a deal with the U.S. saying that they would disavow their connections with Al-Qaeda. So since the February of 2020, not only have they not disavowed their connections with Al-Qaeda, but they've also been found to be in bed with Al-Qaeda in the middle of the capital, Kabul. So it's less about their inability to protect, which obviously there is that angle, but there's also a broader, bigger, more compelling picture of their duplicity. So if they can lie to the U.S. after having signed a deal witnessed by the world, then what else are they lying about? Are they lying about being a partner for maintaining regional and global security in Afghanistan in exchange for being recognized as a government? I think those questions are real, and those questions are things that the world needs to consider.
So in terms of security in Kabul and in Afghanistan more broadly, should the Western world be worried about the rise of a new form of ISIS in terms of terrorist attacks outside of Afghanistan that might be fostered and even planned and prepared for inside Afghanistan?
I think that's a legitimate fear, as long as there is a toehold, not just by organizations like ISIS, but also organizations that are targeting countries in the region. For example, Tajikistan to the north of Afghanistan is extremely worried and concerned about Tajik terrorists who are under the protection of the Taliban. China has long been concerned about what they call Uyghur separatists being in Afghanistan and operating in areas under Taliban control. So there are concerns not just about ISIS, but also about other organizations that pose a threat to the world. And so those concerns exist. And I think those concerns will continue to exist until a more responsible government in Afghanistan is put in place, one that is not only more aligned with the interests of the region and the world, but also is willing to take on these terrorist groups. Because the Taliban, you know, they're saying that they want to be a partner in security for the world, but they're also enabling these Tajik terrorists, they're enabling Al-Qaeda terrorists to have safe haven in that country.
Just to another matter, of course, you were involved in the negotiations to prevent the release of Hekmatullah, a Taliban terrorist and a turncoat who killed three Australian soldiers in Uruzgan in 2012. Why couldn't you stop the release there? What were the forces at play between the United States and Afghanistan that prevented Hekmatullah, you know, being released?
Well, the U.S. signed a deal with the Taliban without including Afghanistan in the negotiating process, without including Australia in the negotiating process, or any other country for that matter, not the U.K., not France, not Germany, nobody. And so that deal obligated the Afghan government to release, the exact words are, up to 5,000 Taliban convicts in Afghan jails. Now, up to 5,000 could mean it could be 1,000, it could be 2,000, it could be 100. There is no mention of specific 5,000 convicts in Afghan custody. But when it came to the implementation of the deal, the Taliban insisted that not only should it be 5,000, but and not up to 5,000, but it should be these specific 5,000 terrorists, among them people who had been involved in mass casualty attacks against Afghan civilians, terrorist attacks against international forces, including the murder of Hekmatullah. Now, in the of the 5,000, the final people that were in our custody that we did our best to prevent the release of included Hekmatullah. And we offered, through the United States as our intermediary, to the Taliban that we are prepared to release any other six Taliban convicts but these. But the Taliban insisted. And they insisted that direct negotiations with the Afghan government would not start as long as these six people were released. So on the one hand, they were increasing their violence in Afghanistan. On the other hand, they were conditioning the start of peace talks on the release of these six. And on the other hand, the U.S. was actually pressuring the Afghan government to just move along with the release of these prisoners so that other aspects of the U.S.-Taliban deal could be implemented. And those other aspects included Taliban disavowing Al-Qaeda. They included Americans withdrawing all of their forces within a 14-month deadline. So there were multiple competing pressures, including security pressures in Afghanistan, pressures on the Afghan government from the U.S., but also the Taliban holding hostage the start of peace negotiations and making it contingent on the release of these six, including Hekmatullah.
Yeah, there'd have to be some regrets about that prisoner swap, given that what we've seen in terms of the violence in the capital and in Afghanistan more broadly. Shuja, thank you so much for your analysis tonight.
Thanks for having me.
That's Ahmad Shuja Jamal. He's the former Director General of International Relations at Kabul's National Security Council, and he co-authored with William Maley, Emeritus Professor of Diplomacy at the Australian National University, a new book titled Decline and Fall of Republican Afghanistan. You're with Andy Park here on RN Drive.
ABC RN helps you understand the world. Find more of our stories on the ABC Listen app.